Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Williams against the United States. Chivalis, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here on writ of certiorari to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The general questions presented are whether Congress, in passing Section 1014 of Title 18 of the United States Code, intended to prescribe the deposit of a bad check or, quote, check kiting, close quotes, and whether a non-collected check upon which a bank extends credit and which is an enforceable obligation can be alleged in an indictment as a false statement underpinning the overvaluation of a security under Section 1014. In this case, there were three counts of an indictment, and Mr. Williams, a petitioner, was convicted on all three counts. The first count was a misapplication count and really is only indirectly an issue in this case. The other two accounts both involved an allegation of the overvaluation of a security, that is, a check, in order to influence the action of a federally, insured bank on an advance or extension of credit.
All three counts were under 1014.
Two counts. Yes, sir. Now, in this case, the Court has limited the consideration on certiorari to two counts, counts two and three. But I think it's significant that we consider what counts two and three were. Count two was the overvaluation of, quote, a security, a check, close quotes, of $58,500, which was deposited, drawn on the Wynn State Bank and deposited in the Pelican State Bank.
At a time when there were no funds to support it?
At a time when there were insufficient funds to support it, yes, sir. And the government...
That would have something to do with its value, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir. It was, it was a check that did not have funds to support it. Yes, sir. Now, that check did clear the bank in the normal course of things. It was not dishonored. It was paid, and it never came back. The other check was a $60,000 check drawn on the Pelican State Bank, which was deposited in the Wynn State Bank, and that covered the first check. That check, too, was paid by the bank and was not returned for insufficient funds, although at the time it was deposited, there were not funds in the bank sufficient to cover it. Now, the Pelican State Bank, which was where it all started, had the choice in that instance of bouncing the check or extending credit on the check, which resulted in an overdraft. It chose to extend credit and have an overdraft. Now, when this transaction started, Mr. Williams had an overdraft at the Pelican State Bank. Now, we asked the Court to bear in mind that this started off with an overdraft at the Pelican State Bank on May the 9th of something over $58,000. The whole transaction ended on May the 11th, 2 days later, with an overdraft at the Pelican State Bank of something less than $60,000. No check was dishonored. No check was bounced. And it was two separate checks. Now, we mention that because we raised this issue in the Court of Appeals. That is the sufficiency of the indictment under Section 1014. The Court of Appeals summarily dismissed that by saying that the argument was without merit because the two transactions at the two banks constitute classical check kiting. And under Payne, which was a Fifth Circuit case, this check kiting falls within the scope of Section 1014. Now, that's significant because they used both counts of the indictment to create the concept of check kiting. And as we know and as this Court has held, you cannot do that. Each count must stand on its own, and you cannot say that if both counts constitute an offense, then one can be used in the aid of the other count unless it's incorporated therein by reference. In this case, it wasn't done. Now, the argument in this case ought to be simple then. In its simplest terms, no crime was alleged in the indictment under counts 2 and 3, and no crime was proved within Section 1014. However, the case has become complicated. It's become complicated because the government contends that a check is a security under Section 1014. Remind the Court of the language of Section 1014. It says, whoever makes a false statement or report, or whoever overvalues land, property, or security for the purpose of influencing a federally insured bank to extend credit or make advances and so on and so forth. Now, it uses the word security, not a security. But in this case, the government claims that a check is a security, and therefore this constituted the overvaluation of a security.
I suppose that a check could be property in any event.
A check could be property, but not in the sense of this code section. A check could be property. But this says land, property, or other security.
Yeah, the point is I don't think we have to look just at security in view of the broader term of property.
Yes, a check could be property. Yes. And the government makes that argument, but not in the context of that. And I'll get further into that.
But it says other security.
That's correct.
And the only property it's talking about is property that's security.
That's correct.
I don't think it does say other security, does it?
It says land, property, or security. Yes.
Stocks would clearly be covered, wouldn't they? Stocks or bonds would be covered
if they are pledged as security. But they're talking about security in the sense of collateral, and this was not that.
You say that it should be read as meaning other security.
Yes, sir. And security in the sense of collateral.
Yes. And you think the legislative history helps you on that?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, why do you think it would help you if it read other security rather than just security?
Well, I think that it's security in the sense of collateral. I think you may apply the doctrine of jus dame generis and say that it relates back to the type of security that land or property is. But I really say that it talks about security in the sense of collateral, not a security in the sense of a stock or a bond used for something other than collateral. The government's position is...
This wouldn't... If you were going to a bank for a loan and they made you fill out a loan application and they wanted to know what your assets were, you fill it out and you overvalued the property that you own by about 10 times.
Yes, sir.
And many times banks don't take security on all of your property. They just want to know how much property you got.
That's correct, sir. That would be a violation.
Well, then it doesn't mean collateral.
No, sir, because there are two elements of it. One of it says whoever shall knowingly makes a false report or statement, a false statement or report. Now, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's not just about collateral.
Well, but it's about if you overvalued security in that sense. That's correct. It's not about collateral.
So the section isn't limited to property that's collateral. It just says property. If the overvaluing that property might influence a bank decision.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Well, must not the statute be read by having the word any modify all the terms that follow, that is, any land, any property, or any security?
I think you could read it that way, sir.
Well, could you read it any other way?
I don't know whether you could or not. You could read it the way it's written, I guess, but I think certainly...
Is this check any property?
Well, it is property, yes, sir. But it was not used, it says, for the purpose of extending, of an extension of credit or an advance or a loan. It's talking in terms of commercial and consumer credit. It's not talking about the presentation of a check to a bank for the purpose of having the bank collect it or whatever purpose the bank uses it for.
What if the bank practice, though, is to immediately credit the account, which was true in this case? If you can immediately draw on that credit, and if it turns out that the check isn't collected, the bank can sue you.
That's least, correct.
Oh well, you certainly are extending an. You certainly are getting credit from the bank.
All right.
If the bank gives you lets you use that money without ever having collected the check.
All right, but you have two things that occur. One is the crediting your account is not an extension of credit. That's been held by one of the circuits, the Crown case, which was recently decided. It's not an extension of credit. But if you say that they draw on that constitutes a commercial loan transaction, then that's one thing. But we submit, Your Honor, that it doesn't. And in order to reach that result in this case, it requires such convoluted reasoning that it does not give a person any warning that under this statute they are violating a criminal law. And we say that, now we didn't raise the constitutional question of impermissible vagueness, but that's what the principle is about.
Long before you get to a constitutional principle of impermissible vagueness, you get to some sort of a principle of leniency and statutory construction.
That's correct, John. And one of you ask about the legislative history. Let me address that question by stating this. This statute, up until 1970, did not include any institution that could accept checks from private customers for deposit. In 1970, the Congress merely passed a law adding certain federally insured banks and federal savings and loan institutions. There was nothing that did anything but that. That's all they did. Now, at the same time, this Congress amended a bad check law in the District of Columbia. That bad check law covers the conduct that the government says ought to be covered here. In that law, they use the words checked, draft, or other instrument used at a bank or that sort of thing. They made it clear what they were talking about. Now, it seems to me that if Congress had intended to include a check or a draft under this statute, all they had to do was what they did when they amended the District of Columbia Act.
Well, why do you concede, then, that a check is property?
Well,
for
a check
of the statute.
A check is property, but not in the terms of the statute.
So you don't consider
No, sir. I say a check is property. A check can even be security, because if I tender to a bank several checks and say, hold this for a loan when I get an extension, when I borrow money from the bank, it can be security. But in the terms of this statute, in this situation, it is not. And the statute was never intended to include that. If they did, why did they say land, property, or security? Why didn't they say what they said in the same year, 1970, when they passed the last amendment to this act, when they added banks and federal savings and loan institutions? Why didn't they say check instead of land, property, or security? We think that's part of the legislative intent. In addition to that, we cite in our brief several situations where we quote from the House Banking and Currency Committee when they say it's intended to cover a borrower. We quote from the Senate Banking and Currency Committee, which talks about the 1970 amendment and said it simply adds institutions that are covered under the Act.
Well, if you go to a bank present a check drawn on another bank and ask for cash, and the bank gives you cash without having collected the check, you know very well that the check isn't any good, do you think you've got a loan from the bank?
No, sir.
What
no,
have you
sir.
Got?
Well, what I've got
do,
is a
do,
normal
do you think you end up owing the bank some money?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir, I would. But that
well, have
happens.
Have you been extended credit?
Well, not under the terms of this statute. Let me explain it this way, because I don't want to dodge the question. Under Louisiana law, when you present a check to a bank for deposit, mm-hmm. you engage that you will, upon notice of dishonor, make that check good. That's so, what so you engage.
Like if you give me the cash or give me the credit, you can treat this check as a note.
Well,
I promise to pay.
It's in the form of a note, yes, sir. It's in the form of a note. And what you do, you engage that, and that's the only representation you make unless you orally or in writing make some other representation.
I promise to pay for this, pay you back for this extension of money.
Well, that's right. You are getting it on an uncollected check. You promise to pay only if the check is dishonored and the bank protests and gives you notice of dishonor.
Well, is this that really any different if you go to the bank and say, please loan me $500, and they say, fine, sign this note, and you sign the note?
Yes, sir, because in that instance, it is a commercial transaction where you are borrowing money. In the other instance, you're merely depositing a check, and they're giving you an immediate credit, which is a unilateral decision on the bank.
It should be even worse because it's interest-free.
Well, there's no evidence in this case it was interest-free.
Let me put another.
This was an overdraft.
Let me put this hypothetical to you. Suppose a man who has a good standing with a particular bank, good standing in the community, so he's trusted.
Yes.
Goes to the bank and hands them a $50,000 check on a non-existent bank, and the signature is forged. Would he have violated this statute?
If he gives them a check on a non-existent bank where the signature is forged.
Signature, but it's payable to him and the bank because it trusts him and simply says, yes, here's your $50,000. Has he violated this statute?
No, sir, I don't believe he has.
You don't think so?
Not this statute. No, sir. Well, now, he has violated all 50 states' bad check laws, which is another thing that is involved in the history and the rule of lenity, and that is that all 50 states in 1970 had bad check laws that covered that conduct, and this has historically and traditionally been the subject of state regulation. And if Congress had intended to make such broad inroads and intrusions into state law, then certainly it should have said something to let people know that that's what it was doing.
May I ask you a question? I wonder if the statute requires that credit be extended pursuant to a false application. In other words, supposing you went into a bank and said, I want to open a checking account, and I'm going to file an application, and you make a lot of false statements on where your other accounts
no,
are.
No, sir, it does not require that.
Because the statutory language is awfully broad.
It is broad, and it says to influence the extension of credit or advance or forbearance and that sort of thing. But it does not have to actually influence as long as it was intended to influence.
Well, if that such an application were merely intended to influence the bank, A, to open the account, and B, to put you on their list of good customers so the next time you come in they'll treat you well, wouldn't that violate the statute?
No, sir. Because they're talking about extensions of credit, advances, loans, commitments, that sort of thing.
It says it's a false statement and so forth upon any application, comma, advance, comma, discount, comma, purchase agreement, repurchase agreement, commitment, or loan. Are they making a commitment to you that they'll deal with you as a depositor?
Well,
or any change or extension or any of the same? It's awfully broad language.
No, sir.
But you just think it does require that is
yes,
good.
Your reasoning is good up to the point where the interpretation of the word commitment is used to commit to open a bank account.
I can understand. That's the central thrust of the statute.
It's an agreement to make a loan or to extend credit in a commercial or consumer-type setting.
Well, this one-sentence statute, like 2 pages long, is difficult to parse down.
I know it is.
But going to that section, that part of it that my brother Stevens just referred to, that's deferment of action or otherwise.
Yes, sir.
That's the broadest possible, isn't it?
Or otherwise.
It seems to embrace almost anything.
Well, the I don't know what other or otherwise means. The only time it has been interpreted was in the Pinto case. And in that case, what they did there, I believe it was the Pinto case, where the man had gotten erroneous credit of $193,000 when it was supposed to be $193. And after it was all found out that he'd gotten the erroneous credit, he lied to the bank. He told an intentional falsehood in order to get them to defer action or otherwise. And they used it in the sense of defining deferring action. And I don't know what it means other than that, but it certainly cannot cover a bad check.
But when you put a check into a bank, do you not, in the words of the statute, influence the bank to extend you the credit that goes with that?
No, sir. I don't think so for two reasons. Number one is when you put the check in the bank, you are not making a statement other than what the law says you're making, and that is that you will pay the check in the event it is dishonored and you have notice of dishonor. All right, that's number one. Number two, it is not security for anything. It is not security for anything. Now, admittedly, under Louisiana law, they have a lien on an uncollected item until such time as they send it out for purposes other than collection or until such time as it's collected. But again, if you have to take the Uniform Commercial Code or if you have to take the Louisiana Revised Statutes and compare them and then say that because they have a lien at some time for some period on uncollected items, then that fits into security or the influencing of a loan in this case, then that's too convoluted to come under a statute which talks about land, property, or security for the extension of credit. And that's one of the points we have made.
Let me go back and see if I understand your answer to my question. Okay. A man goes to the bank with a $50,000 check. It's no good. Because of his standing, they either give him cash or let him cash a check on his personal account for anywhere up to that amount.
Yes.
Has not his conduct influenced the bank to do something very important here?
It's influenced him to issue money on an uncollected item. It has done
that.
That's
yes. Not a violation of
no,
the statute.
No, sir, it's not a violation. It's a violation of a state statute. And if they can prove intent to defraud, it may even come under other statutes. Of course, you have to use the wire or the mails to do that, but this statute is sort of a strict liability statute. You don't have to prove that they intended to defraud, and the government takes a position that the mere giving of a check that at the time it's presented to the bank does not have sufficient funds to cover it, if he's given immediate credit on it, constitutes a violation. I submit to your honors.
An overdraft.
No, sir. No, sir.
Well, surely he says,
no, sir. No, sir. He says knowingly, knowing that at the time it's presented for deposit, that there aren't sufficient funds to cover it. Now, that doesn't mean that he doesn't have a reasonable expectation to cover it when it's presented, and I was just about to say that I submit that everybody has done that. Deposited a check in the bank and covered it the next day at the receiving bank, the drawee bank. But that's what is contended to be a crime, and you don't even have to prove, under the government's contention, that there was an intent to defraud, because this statute does not embrace the intent to defraud. Now, the deposit of in response to Mr. Chief Justice's question, if you take that just a little bit further and you make that a certified check that is known to be false, then I think you could have a violation of this statute. Now, the reason for that is this.
What's the difference?
The difference.
One's more impressive than the other.
No, so the difference is what the legal representation is. As I said before, when you have a check uncertified, the legal representation under Louisiana law is that you will honor it on notice of dishonor. Okay. Now, if it's a check drawn on a bank and it's certified, then the representation is that the bank has the funds already on hand to cover that check and that it will be honored.
That the money has been set aside.
Has been set aside. And that's the representation you make by the mere presentation of the check. And if you know that to be false, then you have made a false representation.
Well, you've made a false representation. I realize that a certified check would maybe be different in that respect. But I thought you said that a check was not either land, property, or security. And therefore, I don't see why that element of the offense would be proved any more by a certified check than by a personal check.
Well, I don't think it is property, land, or security.
Well, then why do you concede that a certified check might violate the statute?
Well, it depends. If you got immediate credit, it might violate the other portion of the statute, Your Honor. A false statement for the purpose of influencing the extension of credit.
Well, but the false statement has to be with respect to any land, property, or security, doesn't it?
No, sir. No, sir. It does not.
You have to willfully overvalue land, property, or security.
No, sir. No, sir. There are two separate elements. A false statement or report has to do with one element to influence. The other is the overvaluation of land, property, and security. Now, that's one of the problems here.
I see.
One of the problems here is they didn't charge this man with the first element, that is, making a false statement or report. They charged him with the second element, and they tried to fit it in by calling it a security. And that's the point I was trying to make earlier.
Well, the second element, this is in the disjunctive, isn't it? Those are two separate offenses, isn't it?
Yes, sir. That's two separate offenses.
Well, I thought perhaps I misunderstood you.
I thought
you were saying the offense had to show two elements.
Well,
a false statement and willful.
No, sir. I was making the opposite point. Yeah. The distinguishing factor is that one of them is a false statement, and security has nothing to do with that. I can make a false statement just by telling you I'm a millionaire. That would be a false statement.
What was your client charged with? Was he charged under one subsection or one?
He was charged with overvaluing, quote, a security, that is a check, close quotes. But they underpin that and try to fit into the false statement section by saying that's based on the fact that he misrepresented or caused to be misrepresented the value of the check because he represented it to be in the face amount of the check, which, of course, it was honored. The funds weren't there, but the bank paid it. It didn't come back, and it wasn't bounced. But the lower court put the two counts together and said this is check kiting, and since Payne holds that check kiting comes under 1014, then that's what we've got here. And that's a jurisdictional question.
Your point, can I just follow up? Your point is that if their theory is right, any time you deposit a check drawn on an account that doesn't have enough funds in it, that you have then violated the statute because you've then overvalued a security.
That's correct. And that's what this charged. Yeah. That's all it charged. You've got to combine the counts to make it charge anything else. And I say it's a very dangerous precedent. People do that every day. Now, the state check laws cover that if it is an intent to defraud, and that's a horse of a different color. I'm saving some time for rebuttal. May it please court.
Mr. Wilkins.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case presents a straightforward question of statutory construction. That question is whether petitioner's deceptive check-writing conduct falls within the reach of a federal statute that specifically proscribes the making of intentional misrepresentations for the purpose of influencing the credit decisions of a federally insured bank.
But Mr. Wilkins, before you get into that, is he not correct that the indictment is confined to the willfully overvaluing portion of the alternatives? So that
no,
the
Your
intentional
Honor.
False statement is not quoted in the indictment anymore.
Count 2 and 3 of the indictment state charge petitioner with knowingly and willfully overvaluing a security.
Right.
It also contains a representation that he presented the checks and caused to be represented to said bank that said check was of a value equal to the face amount of the check, when in truth and fact, as defendant then well knew, there were no sufficient funds.
Where are you reading from, Mr. Wilkins?
That's from page 3 of the joint appendix. So the indictment clearly contains factual statements underlying an allegation of false statement. Furthermore, petitioner's contention at this state of the litigation that the indictment does not charge him with a false statement was not raised either before the trial court or the Fifth Circuit. It is here being raised for the first time with this court and is reviewable only under the plain error doctrine. The government contends that viewing the statute or reading the indictment, the clear language of the indictment meets the sufficiency requirements set forth by this court.
What is a matter of law, however, a check were not a security within the meaning of this statute? It may have been property, but you didn't say overvaluing property. You said a security. Now, suppose as a matter of law, a check were not a security, and suppose count 2 was the only count in the indictment.
Exactly.
Even if you prove he made a false statement, could you convict him under count?
Exactly. The jury in this case, Your Honor, was instructed that a check is a security within the meaning of Section 1014 as a matter of law. The only question put to the jury under the instructions of the trial court was whether or not that check or that security was overvalued. And as even petitioner concedes in his reply brief, the question of overvaluation and false statement in the context of this case are the same.
If the check were not a security within the meaning of the statute, you would have to reverse. Is that it?
No.
Because the trial court misunderstood what a security was?
No. If a check is not a security,
it's just property rather than a security.
If it's just property, for example, the only question that was put to the jury was, is this a false statement? Is it an overvaluation? Mm-hmm. The jury concluded that the check was a false statement, which is a sufficient ground for conviction under the statute. Mm-hmm. So if this court disagrees as a matter of law that a check is not a security.
But you charge that it was a security and that it was overvalued.
Exactly. But even assuming that as a matter of law, as a legal theory, it's not a security, the only factual conclusion reached at the trial below was that it was overvalued.
Because the judge took away from the jury the question whether it was a security or not by charging them under Justice White's hypothesis erroneously that the check was a security.
But even if that is erroneous, the fact still remains that petitioner was properly convicted under the theory that it is a false statement.
Of what?
Of making a false statement.
About what?
The false statement is that he would have had money, that the checks were represented by funds and would have been paid in the normal course of collection when, in fact, such was not the case.
That's not what the indictment alleged, the falsity. The falsity is that when, in truth and fact, as the defendant well knew, there were no sufficient funds in the other bank.
That's
all that was required.
Exactly.
So that all that, in order to make out the offense, as you, under your theory, as I understand it, is you make a deposit with a check that you know does not have enough funds in the drawee bank at the time of the deposit.
For the purpose of influencing a bank upon a loan advance or commitment, exactly.
Well, for the purpose of getting a better bank account, which you can draw against. That's all you allege here. In quite count two, all you really do is allege that the balance in the account was therefore debited, I guess it would be, and they could therefore draw more. You don't allege an actual drawing against that in count two, yet you can't rely on count three.
Or you don't even say it was for the purpose of anything.
That was the illegal purpose, that you knew the other bank was short of the funds.
The count two of the indictment clearly states that it was for the purpose of obtaining an advance of money. The facts of this case demonstrate that each check was presented for the bank to obtain that advance, and
purpose of obtaining the advance would have been achieved whether he ever in fact drew against the account, wouldn't it? He's in a position where the balance has gone up, and therefore there are funds he can draw against. Isn't that all you have to prove? Do you think you had to prove that there was a withdrawal following the deposit?
No, all we have to prove is that the check was deposited for the purpose of influencing the bank upon and
its future course of conduct.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the falsity was an implied representation that there were funds to cover it,
yes,
when in fact he knew there were not.
Exactly. Petitioner contends that a check can't be a false.
That then would be, a conviction resting only on whoever knowingly makes any false statement or report.
Exactly.
And you never get to overvalue.
Right. It is unnecessary to get to the overvaluation of security to sustain petitioner's conviction. Petitioner contends that a check cannot be a false statement because it is simply a promise to pay, a sum certain upon presentment and notice of dishonor.
Well, but if your theory is right, why isn't any deposit of an insufficient funds check within the statute?
Because, Your Honor, this statute only reaches the deposit or the making of knowingly false statements for the purpose of influencing a bank upon a loan, advance, or commitment. Construing Section 1014 to reach this conduct does not sweep up all bad check prosecutions throughout the United States. Bad check laws will continue to apply to bad checks that are given to the neighborhood grocer.
But as I listened to your exchange with Justice Stevens, it sounded like that was exactly what you were saying, and that any time somebody deposits a check, knowing that there are insufficient funds to cover it, this section has been violated.
If that check is deposited for the purpose of obtaining...
Well, if it's deposited in a federally insured bank.
Exactly.
In a federally insured bank.
Knowing that there aren't funds to cover it.
Exactly.
So it has to be a deposit. Well, we have many non-federally insured banks anymore?
I am not aware. I know that there are many states.
This was an addition to the statute, wasn't it?
Excuse me?
Wasn't this an addition to the statute, the federally insured bank?
Yes. The federally insured banks were added to the statute in 1970.
Doesn't that take in almost all of the banks in the United States?
No, there are numerous state chartered institutions that are not.
Well, lots of state chartered institutions are.
Exactly. Many of them are. Petitioner contends that a check is...
Back to Justice O'Connor's question. This surely means that all you have to do is deposit a check in a federally insured bank, knowing that there are insufficient funds to cover it, and you violated this statute.
Knowing that there are insufficient funds to pay the check in the course of collection, if you intend to influence that bank to extend you credit. Now, if, for example, in the circumstances of the Crown case.
I deposit it, and I credit it to my account.
Right.
Or I cash it. In either instance, the requirement for the purpose of extending credit is satisfied, isn't it?
No. For take the example of the Crown case the petitioner mentioned this morning. In that case, the defendants presented checks to a bank that were drawn on a fictitious bank. They were merely deposited in someone's account. There was a credit entry. No one was allowed to withdraw any funds against that check. There was no advance of credit, and the court said there's no violation of 1014 here because although there's a false statement, there was no advance of credit. All there was a bookkeeping entry.
Well, some banks have that as a practice. This
check that you've deposited is just not subject to being drawn on until we collect it.
Exactly. But in the facts of this case, petitioner deposited a check on May 9th. It was immediately credited to his account and used to wipe out approximately $58,000 in overcharges.
Did he know when he deposited it that he would have immediate credit?
The jury found, on the facts of this case, the jury was instructed that petitioner could not be convicted unless defendant intended to write checks which he could not reasonably expect to cover and therefore defraud the bank. And on the evidence presented, or the evidence before the jury in this case, demonstrated that petitioner certainly was aware.
At least you would say then that any time
somebody knows it's a custom of the bank to give you immediate credit and you deposit a check that you know has insufficient funds behind it, but that you know you'll get immediate credit that's usable, then the statute is violated.
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand. Does it depend on what the defendant intends, or does it depend upon what the bank does in its accounting practices, or both?
It depends, Your Honor. It would be a factual question. It depends on what the defendant intends. Of course, the defendant's knowledge of a bank's accounting practices would certainly be material in determining whether...
Well, doesn't every defendant who deposits an insufficient funds check intend that he receive credit for it?
No, Your Honor. If there are facts showing that he intended to receive credit, in this case, on May 8th, federal and state bank examiners arrived to commence an audit. There was a $58,000 overcharge in his account. Mr. Williams, or petitioner, was certainly and justifiably concerned to eradicate this overdraft status. And he deposited the check and he did, in fact, achieve.
Can't the trier of fact reasonably infer from any deposit slip that the depositor intends to get credit?
40 years ago, they had an expert staff.
No, Your Honor, I think that it would that the intention to influence a bank on an extension of credit would have to be a determination that would be made in light of all of the facts and the evidence that was presented in an individual case.
But can you conceive of anyone in their right mind giving a bank a check for that's not in not sufficient funds to cover it and simply planning to wait and let the check go through the clearinghouse and be returned NSF?
No.
That certainly isn't the intent of any rational person.
No.
So isn't Justice O'Connor right when she says that anyone who presents an NSF check must be planning to get credit on it?
In some circumstances, I can see that that would be the case.
Well, one of the banks that has a practice of not permitting withdrawals until the check has been collected. This was not known to the depositor, and the depositor deposited it, knowing that there were insufficient funds at the time. Would he be guilty in that context?
No. He deposited the check intending to obtain an extension?
He did, but unknown to him at the time, the bank's practice was it would not permit any withdrawals against the check until it had been collected.
That defendant, I presume, would have violated the statute because he would have presented a false statement with the intent to influence the bank upon an application.
Even though it was impossible that he...
Even though it was impossible, the statute is geared to protect federally insured banks against false statements that are designed to influence them. Whether or not they're actually influenced is irrelevant.
Well, then it seems to me, as my colleagues down here have said, that this covers every bad check case.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't.
As long as you know that you haven't got insufficient, that you do not have sufficient funds.
No, because it
well,
only.
The guy's a fool if he. otherwise, it must be. He knows that the check is no good, and he goes to the bank and presents it. Why is he presenting it if he knows he's not going to get the money until the bank finds out that there's no money?
Well, this only extends to these false statements that are made to federally insured banks for this purpose. The vast majority of insufficient funds checks cases do not involve statements that are made to federally insured banks. They involve statements that are made grocers or...
Right, then, but then you say it would cover all cases presented to a federal...
To a federally insured bank. Yes, Your Honor.
It's taken a long time to get to that.
A check... The alternative ground for liability under Section 1014, as we have mentioned, is that a check constitutes overvalued land, property, or security. A check clearly qualifies as overvalued security within the meaning of Section 1014 because the term security, as it has been generally defined throughout Title 18 of the United States Code, includes any item that stands for some other thing of value.
Okay, now you say that it's been generally defined that way throughout the United States, Title 18 of the United States Code. Do you mean that definition covers the word security in Section 1014?
It is generally applicable, or that definition may be used to ascertain Congress's probable intent in using the word security in this statute.
What section do you rely on?
For example, 8 U.S.C. 2311, the National Stolen Property Act, and the general...
Well, that just defines it for purposes of that act, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's for purposes of that act.
Well, then why do you say it's applicable to this act?
It's not directly applicable, Your Honor. It's only applicable to show that as the term has been defined in other contexts, general criminal law context, it has been defined to include any item that stands
for
something.
Well, I would think the inference is quite the contrary, that if Congress has taken occasion to define it broadly and said for purposes of some other act, the fact that it has not taken occasion to define it broadly here may cut against you.
The broad term of the statute, nevertheless, we contend should be used consistently as the term security has been used consistently throughout Title 18 of the United States Code.
course, this is just an alternative argument.
Exactly. It's just an alternative argument, and this Court need not agree that a check is a security to affirm petitioner's conviction. Petitioner spends considerable effort detailing in his brief the legislative history of Section 1014, but he has been unable to demonstrate a clearly expressed legislative intent to exclude his conduct from the reach of the statute. Petitioner argues from sparse legislative history
Do you feel it's the burden on a criminal defendant to show that he's not covered by the statute, or that it's the burden of the government to show that he is covered by it?
It's the burden of the government, of course, Your Honor, to show that he is covered, but there would be a presumption, I assume, the burden in face of clear statutory language. This Court has often stated that where you have clear language, in the absence of a clearly expressed legislative intent to the contrary, the statute will be given its clear, plain meaning. The fact that there is no express mention of petitioner's conduct in the legislative debates of Section 1014 is, of course, irrelevant. As this Court stated in Barr v. United States, if Congress has made a choice of language that fairly brings a given situation within a statute, it is unimportant that a particular application might not have been contemplated by the legislators. The federalism concerns noted by petitioner in his brief and in argument do not loom large in this case. The federal government has a paramount and indeed a very important, a very strong interest in maintaining the viability and the assets of federally insured institutions. The conclusion that Section 1014 extends to the presentation of all knowingly worthless checks that are presented for the purpose of influencing the credit decision of a federally insured bank.
Not knowingly worthless, knowingly overvalued.
Knowingly overvalued.
It could be 10 cents over, I suppose. It's still, I mean, if the amount in the other account is only a couple of dollars below the amount of the check, you'd still have a violation.
If it is.
Doesn't that be worthless?
Well, if it is done knowingly. Exactly. You have to know, Your Honor, that the check will not be paid in the due course of collection. Plus, the instructions in this case, the court specifically instructed the jury here that petitioner had to be engaged in conduct where he well knew that the checks would never be paid, and he engaged in this solely for the purpose of obtaining time and credit. The rule of lenity, so often invoked by petitioner, applies only where there is a grievous ambiguity in the language or structure of the Act that is entirely lacking on the facts of this case. And the numerous hyper-technical objections to his indictment and the instructions of the trial court, as I've already mentioned, were raised for the first time before this Court and do not rise to the level of plain error requiring reversal of his conviction. Petitioner's final argument is that his conviction must be reversed because a check-kiting conviction requires the prosecution to prove an intent to defraud. The short answer to this contention is that petitioner was not indicted for check-kiting. He was indicted for making an intentional false statement or willfully overvaluing a security for the purpose of influencing a federally insured bank upon a loan, advance, or commitment. Each count of his indictment clearly sets forth those facts, clearly sets forth those allegations, and is sufficient to sustain a statutory violation. The term check-kiting, as used throughout the government's brief and by petitioner, is simply descriptive of petitioner's conduct. The question here is not whether this conduct requires some specific intent to defraud in order to be culpable, but rather whether petitioner's conduct that can be described as check-kiting falls within the reach of a federal statute that prohibits intentional misrepresentations for the purpose of influencing the credit decisions of a federally insured bank. As stated in petitioner's reply brief, the overall question is whether the allegations of counts 2 and 3 are subject to prosecution under Section 1014, regardless of how they are labeled. No matter how one labels the conduct of petitioner, it clearly comes within the reach of Section 1014 and states a violation of that statute. Petitioner's conviction should be affirmed.
Very well. Do you have anything further?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please court, if I can make just two quick points, and one of them has to do with what this indictment is all about. They say we didn't raise the issue of false statement until we got up here. The statute is couched in the alternative. It says either a false statement or overvaluing security. Now, they didn't, if you look at the indictment, it says that he overvalued security in that he presented the check and represented it was of a value in its face amount. They did not make a specific charge of making a false statement. They used that to underpin the charge of overvaluing a security.
So you're saying you didn't know you were facing a charge of a false statement?
No, sir. This is the first time we realized it is when we got cert to this court. We used it as an argument because it underpins the overvaluing of security. And let me mention one other thing. This case was tried on check type. That's the unfortunate thing about this case, and that's why if this court determines that in this case the court was in error and it should be reversed, it should reverse count 1-2. The judge charged the jury that the defendant was being charged with check kiting. The two witnesses, an FBI agent, testified it was check kiting, and a bank examiner testified it was check kiting.
Well, there is no statute that anywhere, is there, that describes it in terms of check kiting?
That's correct. That's correct. And I really don't know what check kiting is. Blacks gives three definitions, and Words and Phrases give two others that are broadened. And let me tell you just one other minute about it. Opposing counsel has stated that this wasn't check kiting. In the joint appendix, we show the government charges that Mr. Williams was involved in check kiting, and that's a direct quote. Let me give one other example about what Justice O'Connor mentioned. Let's assume that a person has two banks that they operate out of, that on the way to Bank A to deposit a check, they stop at Bank B and deposit a check on Bank A. They have the check in their pocket to deposit in Bank A. They then go to Bank A and deposit that check, but until they deposited that, Bank A did not have sufficient funds to cover the check at Bank B. That is a violation under this indictment as charged in this case of the law. And that's all it takes, no intent to defraud, as long as that bank credits their account with that check instead of waiting for collection.
Or even if they don't?
Even if they don't do it. Now, opposing counsel said it was bank's decision to use overdrafts to wipe out that, and that's true, it was bank's decision. My time's up. I want to make one of those.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.